You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko just a mongtoke ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, rapare te rā te kou o whiriranga o nuku. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 10th of October. I'm Justin and I am with you for the next hour. Stuart and Mary Margaret's away this week, but we are graced with the return of Louis Laws. It's good to have you back. How are you today?
Bloody good to be back, Justin. I'm much better now that I'm here in studio with you.
Yes, it's I feel comforting when someone's in the studio with me.
Yes, as do I.
Yes, It's good to have you back anyway.
Yeah.
FIQA coming up on the show today. I talked to Finance Minister Grant Robertson about the government surplus. International Desk returns this week, and we are looking back at the life of the late French President Jacques Chirac. I talked to Dr. Louis.
It's something that I must request. I will be talking with Dr. Lara Greaves of the University of Auckland about voter turnout at our local elections, and then producer Jack Marshall will be discussing with Dr. Julian Molyneux of the Political Observatory on the problems with local elections and how to improve them.
And finally, Neighbourhood Watch is also back, and we go across the ditch to our correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe. As always, he aha or whakaro, let us know your thoughts throughout the show. Tuka pātuhi mai, you can text on 5395, or wire my calls in studio on 309-3879, or tweet us at 95BFM News. Me kaua e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene korero ano hei pakihere roki roki marunga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. Don't forget, you can catch all these stories in full and more by podcast on our website, 95BFM.com. I tēnei wā tonu, and now...
Irirangi poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The government has announced that there has been a surplus of $7.5 billion. This is the biggest budget surplus in a decade, more than double of the forecast. So, where does the surplus come from and how is the government going to spend the extra money? I talked to Finance Minister Grant Robertson about it yesterday.
Yeah, so this relates to the government's accounts for the year that ended on the 30th of June. And most years over recent times, the government's been in a position to be able to announce what's called an operating surplus. That's made up of a lot of different things. And particularly this year, what we've seen is several one-off things have happened. So, for example, there's been a re-evaluation of the value of our rail assets, which has increased the surplus up a bit. There's been some changes to the way that the tax system works. So we have a bit more information about estimating how much tax has come in and also bringing forward some people's tax payments. But overall, you know, while it's a $7.5 billion surplus, it's a, you know, when you take out those one-off factors, it's sitting a little bit above where we'd forecast it to be. That's because essentially companies have been making larger profits, people have been earning higher wages, and people have been spending more, and that's meant that our tax taken corporate tax and PAYE and GST has increased, and so that's meant that we have through the year had more money to be able to use, and now as we move into the new financial year, we are using that to invest in our infrastructure and pay for the public services that we need.
What sort, when you say our new public services, what sort of things that the government is planning to invest in?
So with the budget that effectively started on the 1st of July this year, we've got a significant boost in the health spending, and you would have heard possibly in the budget about the fact that we're putting about $1.9 billion into mental health issues, so we're doing a lot there. Big boost of funding in education as well. We're also working around housing issues and investing there, so it's right across the board. And in infrastructure, you know, that's really about building hospitals and schools, making sure we put the money that we need into our transport networks, especially our rail network. So all of those things have already happened, and what we'll continue to do is look for other opportunities to be able to invest, taking into account the international environment we're in and the fact that, you know, our rates of growth have slowed a bit, so we've got to, you know, bear that in mind as we look ahead to the year. But we're in a really good position as a country to make those investments that we've already planned and look for new ones where the need arises.
Is the government planning to spend part of its surplus on environment initiatives such as combating climate change, or what about poverty and inequality that the Labour Party campaigned so hardly on during the last general election?
Yep, absolutely, and those are both big parts of our agenda. So in terms of environmental issues, you know, the budget contained around $220 million worth of work to support moving to more sustainable land use and improving our water quality. We've got big investments in the kind of science and research that needs to happen to help us lower our emissions, help us transition to new energy sources, things like hydrogen, and we've got a big work program going and investing in that. So there's a significant investment there. On poverty and inequality, you know, one of the big flagship projects in this year's budget was to index main benefit rates to average wages, and over time that's going to make a really big difference to families that they've got more income. In the year that we've just been talking about, in terms of the accounts, is when we brought our families package in that, you know, that put around $5.5 billion into the pockets of low and middle income families. So these are really important parts of our program. Managing our government finances carefully gives us the ability to be able to make those investments. So we've done that in budget 2019, and we'll continue to look for opportunities to keep doing that.
The National Party, they have claimed that the surplus is, and I quote, come at the expense of hardworking New Zealanders who have been taxed to the eyeballs. What is your response to that?
Oh, I just fundamentally disagree with that. In terms of the tax settings, we haven't actually changed this significantly. The tax settings, what this is about is actually that people are earning higher wages and they're therefore, the tax take from that has increased. Companies are doing better, and so we're getting more back in terms of their taxation. But actually, the settings themselves haven't changed. And actually, what we are doing is investing in the areas that were neglected for 9 years by the National Party. You know, the reason why we're needing to put so much money into our schools and our hospitals and fixing up our rail network and investing in roads and around the country is because that didn't happen over a 9-year period. So I think we've got the balance about right. We're investing heavily in those areas. We need resources to do that. That's what New Zealanders want us to do. But at the same time, we've been careful and we've lowered our debt ratios and we've managed to have a surplus as well.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That was Finance Minister Grant Robertson talking about the government surplus. Let me know what you think. How should the government spend its surplus? You can do so by texting us on 5395 or call us in studio 309-379. And now?
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
On International Desk this week, we are going to Paris, as former French President Jacques Chirac has died aged 86. His political career spanned for 4 decades, as he was the mayor of Paris and the prime minister of France before elected as the president of France in 1995. While our understanding of him is mostly on his opposition to the Iraqi war in 2003. So, who is Chirac and what kind of president was he? I talked to François Martini, a professor of political science at the University of Nice and L'École Polytechnique in Paris.
So Jacques Chirac has been the president of France for 12 years, between 1995 and 2007. And before that, he's been a very long-term politician, starting his career in the 1960s, being 9 times a member of parliament, 7 times a minister, and twice a prime minister. So he's somebody who's been dominating the life of the French right, because he was a conservative leader, for half a century. But at the same time, he's somebody who, when he was in power, was doing very little, and so he's more remembered for a couple of speeches that he gave, and also, and more importantly, for the way that he opposed the U.S. in the war in Iraq. So he refused to send French troops in Iraq because he believed that this war was illegitimate, and so he will be remembered for that. And his impact was really as such, but more than for precise policies that he's been given as president, for instance.
When you said earlier that Chirac had a lot of influence on the French right, what sort of French conservative was he?
So Jacques Chirac started his career under General de Gaulle in the cabinet of Georges Pompidou, who was then the prime minister of General de Gaulle at the end of the 1960s. So he's somebody who knew the very beginning of the modernity of the French right with General de Gaulle, and then he's been an important minister in the cabinet of Georges Pompidou, the next president after de Gaulle. Then he was the prime minister of Mr. Giscard, the next president after Mr. Pompidou. Then he was the prime minister in opposition to Mr. Mitterrand, the socialist president. So he was there at every stage of the history of the French right. He's somebody who knew all the ideological trends, and he himself invented or formed a new party called the RPR, the Rassemblement pour la République, who was one of the first neo-Gaullist party existing in 1976, which was also the first party of the French right for 25 years between 1976 and 2002. So if somebody was at all levels in terms of strategy, in terms of leadership, in terms of even ideology, was one of the main leaders of the right for these times. So that's what I meant.
So did France move to the right politically under Chirac's presidency? Because when he ran for election in 2002, his main opponent was the far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen, instead of a socialist party candidate.
Yes, probably that's right. Also because Chirac, after many ideological turns, he was somebody who was not very structured on the ideological side. He was somebody who could change his mind very easily on very important issues. After being quite right in the 1980s, when he got elected in 1995, was elected on a centrist move, on a centrist position, and a centrist platform. And he's somebody who started to claim to embody the Republic, which is a very, once again, a very centrist say in France. And so he turned his back to the more extreme part of the right, which was the wing that he defended when he was in the opposition, and started to be more, as I said, the centrist Republican. So he opened, let's say, a circle, or he opened a space on his right to the extreme right, and this space was used by Jean-Marie Le Pen, among others. So once again, I'm not sure it's only the responsibility of Mr. Chirac that Jean-Marie Le Pen and the extreme right emerged. I don't think he's the only one to blame, but probably part in his game, even though I have to say that as a president, he always opposed and fought the extreme rights with all the energy that he had.
And moving on to a little bit to his leadership style, even though Chirac, his late political career was clouded by various scandals, he seemed to be still very popular in France. So what is that made him so popular?
Well, I think he was popular for what he was, Jacques Chirac was an epitome of a sort of Frenchness. A sort of Frenchness with mixed a sense of humour. He was somebody very humoristic. A taste for life. He was an amazing eater. He had a passion for also for seduction and for women. So he's a man of his time. Once again, I'm not too sure that this passion for women would be as accepted in the post-Me Too sense of events. But at this time, he was an embodiment of a certain style of French man, or Frenchness in general, certain optimism in life, a certain reserve also on his personal feelings. His mix, once again, his wit also made that he was a character that the French could relate to as something very intimate to them. So, and also the fact that he's been around for 50 years made that people from every corner of French politics liked him, because they knew him. And it's better a devil you know, as you know the expression. So he was a devil that everybody knew and everybody liked in a certain way, which is something very striking when you see what happened when he died, the amazing unanimity in the praise that he received as a human being, as somebody which whose human qualities were really once again praised and noted and admired. So I think the reason why Jacques Chirac will be remembered was for what it was more than for what it did. And that's I think, a very typicity, a strong specificity of his career and his life.
But could have his personality made this political shift as well?
No, I don't think so. On the contrary. No, I think it's very independent. I think the personality of Chirac was, on the contrary, something that was a publicity for centrism, in the sense that, once again, he was, as his time in power, a very balanced personality. No, what I think was possible, though, is that his centrism in politics, connected to a very tempered personality, probably created a space for those who really wanted action, because he appeared as somebody, as I said, who didn't do very much. Somebody who was quite a president of inaction for 12 years. So maybe that opened a space for people who were angry about it, who wanted to do something about it, and in the circles of the extreme right and the radical right, and more, let's say, right of action, maybe some, including Nicolas Sarkozy, for example, believe that they would do better than the president as possible.
Would you say that Chirac's passing meant the end of an era in French politics? Because his successors, Nicolas Sarkozy, was once criticised by Chirac himself as being un-French. And this was the same case as François Hollande, who was so uncharismatic, and now Emmanuel Macron, who seemed to be very unpopular in France.
Well, let's not forget that at the end of his mandate, Mr. Chirac was very, very unpopular. So once again, you know, the French have a tendency to praise their president when they die, but hate them when they're in power. So that's probably one of the typicity of French politics and French political culture. But let's say, to answer your question, that Mr. Chirac was probably, in some ways, one of the last presidents of the 20th century, because he was a man who was in power, but also in politics for a very long time, in a world that now favours more limited political career in time. So it makes a very big difference with before. He's somebody, once again, who had some time to enter into people's consciousness and people's memory. So he's somebody also who lived, was the last president to live through a war. He has been sent to fight in Algeria in the decolonization war in Algeria. So he's somebody who knew what it means to be at war concretely, and he's somebody who knew a very long time of agitated history in France. He knew May 68, he knew the war in Algeria and decolonization, he knew the oil boom, the economic crisis. Somebody is very, who can be, let's say, confounded with the history of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century. But he's also a man of the 21st century, once again, as I said, in the way that, like his successors, his words will have been more important than his actions. And I think that's a criticism you can make to him as somebody who was not an old-style politician, in the sense that old-style politicians pretended to transform reality, and Mr. Chirac was only interested in taking power and be able to climb this mountain of French power, and as such, he succeeded. But when he was in power, he couldn't do anything about it, like probably Mr. Sarkozy, Mr. Hollande, or even Mr. Macron today, who are in the same situation of being excellent at getting to power, but then lots less interesting as exercising power, with a strong incapacity to change reality.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
And that was Professor François Martini talking about the political legacy of former French President Jacques Chirac, who passed away recently. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire maronga iri rangipoho. You are listening to The Wire on 95 BFM, and we are having a quick break.
all sus for exams?
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, well, I just have to finish my late assignment and get my notes together and buy a pen. Oh.
And, like, chill out and focus a little bit?
Yep, definitely on my list. Yep, mm-hmm, yep, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Studying? Need to focus? New Good Health Brain Power is scientifically researched to support information uptake, mental clarity, and focus. Good Health Brain Power. Ideal stress support for a clear mind. Read the label and use as directed. If symptoms persist, see your healthcare professional. Good Health Products, Auckland.
This week at the Hollywood Avondale.
Thursday at 8 p.m. Commando on 35mm. The epitome of 80s action cinema starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You're a funny guy, Sally. I like you.
Sunday at 2 p.m. Hal Ashby's 1971 classic, Harold and Maude. Then at 5 p.m. Dr. No. A rare Technicolor 35mm print featuring Sean Connery as the original
Bond.
James Bond.
James Bond.
Come early. Every screening has pre-show oddities plus vegan treats and mulled wine.
The Hollywood Avondale, your local independent church of cinema.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind.
Arcade Radio.
Show me that your mind, alright.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
I'm Paddy Garin. This is the fucking news on The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and we are now talking about voter turnout, are we, Louis?
Yes, we are. The local elections are in full swing this year, with the predicted voter turnout for this Saturday's local election heading for an all-time record low. It seems turnout has been slipping every 3 years, with current estimates for 2019's local elections unlikely to be above 40%. So who's to blame for this crisis of voter decline? Is it on the voters, or do we just have an out-of-date system? Well, I spoke with Dr. Lara Greaves, a lecturer in politics and public policy at the University of Auckland, about the current climate surrounding these local elections, as well as solutions for voter certainty in the future.
That speaks to one of the broader issues that we found across this election period, is that people don't actually know how to vote. So they've put up various what they call one-stop shops around for Auckland and around the country, where you can go and vote, but the kind of information about where they are or when they're up is not particularly accurate. We're seeing that voter turnout is down at this point when you compare it to earlier elections, so Local Government New Zealand provides that data. But I think one of the things we have to be a little bit careful about before we kind of go, oh no, it's all broken, it is broken, but before we kind of stress out about this particular election, is that the post is a lot slower nowadays. So I'm a survey researcher, and I've been doing survey research for about 8 years. And every single year, the post gets slower. Someone did some research that showed that, on average, each week, one post box is removed from Auckland. So the postal service is a lot worse. But it does seem like overall voter turnout's going to be down compared to it's pretty bleak, pretty low turnout from last election. So that's kind of, I think, a concern for a lot of us.
Right off the bat there, as you can tell, myself, I'm not too familiar with what we can do about our voting now. So that's quite shocking. I mean, what is this level
of... Yeah, none of us are.
No.
This is the issue. None of us are. And, like, I'm not, and I literally teach this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so what does this level of engagement and voter turnout tell us about these local elections? Like you said, is the system working or is it broken? What can we say about what's happening?
So one line of thought is that it's not broken, and the fact that it's not broken is why we don't vote.
Yes.
So if something really bad was happening, then we would all just go and vote. I don't necessarily buy that line of reasoning, because I think that depends on a lot of things, like whether we are paying attention enough or whether the media is interested enough for us to know whether it is working or not. Because a lot of us would say, sort of like, for example, district health boards, that a lot of us have had pretty negative experiences, I think, with sort of, say, mental health or with health services. And so we know that that's not working. A lot of us probably have bad experiences with rubbish collection or all those other sort of little things that's the easy one to go to for local council. Or like car parking or like parks, or we've all kind of got those issues in our day-to-day lives, but I think a lot of people don't connect those to necessarily, that book that I get sent in the post every 3 years, if I even get it, people don't connect those things. There's also such an informational cost because, I mean, I sat down on a Saturday night the other night and voted, which was a wild time, and sat down with my little booklet, and I was sitting there and looking on that policy, the spin-off, that app, which is great for because a number of candidates, and I would recommend that for people, a number of candidates, if they're still not voted, a number of candidates have filled in sort of surveys with sort of their policy priorities. But that's really, that and the different sort of websites or like Facebook pages or whatever brochures you've gotten in the mail and actually picked up your mail, that's the only way we can really get information on any of the candidates, unless you kind of know them already or like there's not really that sort of connection there. They kind of pop up in this sort of month time where they're campaigning, when the election is on. But other than that, we don't really necessarily, for a lot of us, make those connections. I think it's a little bit different if you are someone who, say, has lived in the same house for 20, 30, 40 years, because then you have those community connections. You know Bob, although probably his name's John, but you know John from up the road, because there are, you know, there are more local councillors called John than there are born after 1980.
Yes,
but you know John up the road, and so you've had a cup of tea with him. Like, I don't know, he spayed your cat that one time, or I don't know, he did something, you know, he did your taxes, he did something. So you know that guy, John. But for a lot of us, we don't know the people at all. So the actual informational cost, and this seems to be one of the clear issues, is that, and most surveys are showing this as well, is that we don't have the, like, how do we know anything about these people? Firstly, we don't know anything about the system. Secondly, we don't know anything about these people. And then on top of that, a lot of people didn't get their voter packs, or they don't even know if they're enrolled or not. Like, I teach third year New Zealand politics, and I go, who's voted? And it's bleak. So, if we as sort of quite involved politics people haven't done all of this, there's just so many different kind of kinks or issues in the system that need working out.
Yeah, there really seems to be this, like, perceived background, I guess, of increased awareness and, you know, active engagement in political issues, you know, amongst younger voters. However, this seems to be the demographic that is lacking when it comes to representation in these local elections. Shifting focus now, I have questions about e-voting. With the steady decline in voter participation, there seems to be this rush towards the so-called silver bullet of local body elections. So what are your thoughts on online voting?
So my thoughts are that it's not a silver bullet, but because a lot of the work overseas has shown that for those people who are most likely to vote, those sort of more middle-aged people that have the people that have been living in their house for X number of years and have that sort of certain socioeconomic status, those people, it's convenient for them and it's great for them. They just instead of posting, they just go online. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily motivate that voter turnout in that younger bracket. And then, of course, a lot of people have been putting forth issues around online security. So first, I think we actually do need to move to online voting or try and figure it out because of the thing I said before about how the post boxes are declining with time. So as survey researchers, you know, we all get together and whinge about this, is that the cost of post goes up substantially every year. Just like every July, we get hit with a bigger bill. And further to that, post boxes are being removed, so people don't necessarily know where post boxes are. That's because we've seen this overall decline in getting mail. I don't think, before I posted off my forms, I don't think I'd posted anything this year.
No.
And I think that's probably, fairly. I asked my mum, you know, this is such anecdotal evidence, asked my mum and people in her generation, had you posted anything?
Yeah.
And a lot of them hadn't. Have you posted anything?
I don't think I've posted anything. I need to still send a letter to Nana.
So we're not posting things. So I think that's where online voting is going to fill that gap. But then they're going to have to figure out how they're going to do that. Are they going to do that through those Real Me accounts that we have through the sort of, we normally access, say, the IRD and our student loans and stuff like that through them? Are they going to use those or how are they going to do that? It seems like a lot of people have been sort of suggesting that we move towards more something like there being, so we see this with the general election, there being voting booths in supermarkets. So having voting booths in a consistent spot for the 2 to 4 weeks, maybe kind of period leading up to the election, where people can go and cast their vote face to face and they just have the sort of forms there. You don't have to think about your enrolment and you just do it as an errand when you're out and about. That seems to be probably where people are saying that that's possibly better. I would like to see it all happen So why do we have general election and then a local election a different year? Like, why don't we just do it all in one? Give us a public holiday. We'll have some, I don't know, like the Australians have their democracy sausages. You know, get a bouncy castle. One of my students suggested, why don't we have a bouncy castle at the bowling booth? But we just could then just, as communities, just get it done rather than moving towards, oh, this system and then this system and, oh, this one's going to go online and it's going to cost this much. And then on top of that, would we have the same online system in Auckland as they do in Palmy? Would Dunedin have the same online system? You know, all that sort of stuff is just...
It gets finicky. And, voting, it really shouldn't be a chore. I mean, it's a task, but it's something that is exercising your, you know, a democratic right to vote. So, you know, people should be excited for this. But really, there doesn't seem to be engagement. I mean, already serious attempts were made in both 2016 and 2019 towards this kind of online voting. It still remains a campaign. So, you know, these systems aren't implemented in New Zealand. It could even be until 2022 that we might see them pop up. But if we don't, how would you suggest, or how should we in the next 3 years push this margin further for local politics? How can we have a higher voter turnout and halt the decline?
This is like such a big question, right? I've never heard anyone come up with a good answer to that.
So far, yes.
Like nothing. And I think part of it, like we've been having discussions, you know, like in sort of political science, that you need to have, there needs to be some mechanism by which people see local government affecting their day-to-day life between election cycles. And whether that's just that there are, I don't know, because if you think, whether there are some kind of, there are ways that candidates kind of connect to voters between elections. I think Richard Hills on the North Shore is pretty good at doing that. I've seen other ones. I'm hopeful for someone like Louise Hutt to keep from Hamilton to keep connecting to people through the election cycles. There needs to be some kind of connectivity between that, beyond just the local meeting or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I think that's really hard when you've got a lot of people, especially in Auckland, that move house so much and aren't necessarily even going to know who their local candidates and stuff are, or local board members are. I think some of them actually do a great job of getting up to meetings and stuff, but a lot of the public, just have no idea who they are. We need some kind of way to connect to them between elections.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was Dr. Lara Greaves speaking with me about voter turnout, as well as discussing the future of local elections with online e-voting. Now, the suggestion of online voting has been tossed around for a while now, and with local election turnouts at an all-time low, it has been touted as an answer to the falling figures of local votes. Yet new research from the Auckland University of Technology suggests this won't address the issue of engagement. Dr. Julian Molyneux, a director of the Policy Observatory, says voting in local elections is far too complex with too many options and few clear opinions for voters to recognise. While voting, online voting may give ease of access for those already interested, it will not break down the structural issues that keep people from voting. So producer Jack Marshall spoke with Dr. Molyneux about what the problem is with local elections and how we might improve them.
Two things here. Firstly, turnout in local elections has always been much, much lower than in our parliamentary elections. So this is not new. The concern is that turnout is falling. And if you continue that trajectory, we're going to get to the point where very few people are voting at all. And the elected local authorities really won't be able to claim that they've got a mandate from voters to do the things that they do. So I think that's where the concern is. If we compare a parliamentary election to a local election, they're actually really different. A parliamentary election, for people who don't follow politics closely, is actually quite easy to participate in. Mostly, you've got two questions to answer. What party do I give my party vote to, and which candidate do I want as my local MP? Those are the only decisions you have to make. And at a minimum, you can break that down to one decision, which is just the party vote. And you give your candidate vote to the candidate from the party you're giving your party vote to. So if you are busy living your life in between elections, not paying attention to the ins and outs of daily politics, you can still make a pretty good and informed decision come election time. Because we have political party branding, most people know which parties are closer to them in terms of their values and which ones are further away. most people will have a sense of, do they want the current government to continue or would they like a change? And so it's quite an easy task to vote in a parliamentary election. Local elections, on the other hand, are really, really hard. You have to be quite committed to complete that ballot. Some places in Auckland are going to have five different fields they have to fill in if they've got a licensing trust. You've got different instructions for every single field. You've got a list of people to vote for that you've quite possibly never heard of before until the billboards went up. You have no idea how the incumbents are performing, and you don't know what their values are. You don't know what they stand for. Because a lot of people in local government stand as independents, and that doesn't tell us anything useful as voters. And so if you don't follow local government politics, the ins and outs of it throughout the whole 3 years, it's actually a really, really, really difficult task to complete that ballot. And it's no wonder that a lot of people give up.
I just have to almost agree with you completely. I study politics full-time at Auckland University. And right. I was looking at the voting sheet, and it was just kind of, I've never heard of these people or the things they stand for, and I kind of do this full-time. And so, for anyone else that's not particularly interested, it's just got to be absolutely confusing. You mentioned that, like, overseas there has been trials of this online voting.
Yep.
What are some of the pitfalls? What can we learn from the experiences overseas?
So online voting overseas tends to be done at below the parliamentary level elections. There's only one country that has online voting for their parliamentary election, and that's Estonia. Every other country has decided that the security risks or the benefits of online voting just don't warrant introducing it for their parliamentary or presidential elections. So it's used at a subnational level, at provincial elections, regional elections, state elections, municipal elections, things like that. One of the lessons that comes from that is that sometimes you do get a slight bump in your turnout when you introduce online voting, because online voting makes it more convenient to vote so long as you're already motivated to vote. So it's a convenience factor. But what it doesn't do is solve the really deep turnout issues. If people are disconnected from their local authorities, just transferring the ballot from a piece of paper to a screen doesn't do anything to make it easier for them to vote. And so the message from overseas is that it doesn't solve turnout problems. It's much more about convenience for existing voters.
Right, I think you kind of touched on an important point there where it's not just the fact that you can vote online, but I was pondering that if we have more information online, kind of a multi-pronged approach, so it could be that you can vote online and there's more information online all in the same space, so there can be more information as well as access out there, which might work to improve the voter turnout.
Yeah, well, the setup we have at the moment is really fragmented. So each local authority organises its own elections and organises its own promotion. And then you get all these other groups like Generation Zero and the spin-off with Policy NZ putting out voter guides as well. And so your information is in lots of different places. And I think that if we could streamline things so that people had to do a bit less searching around to get the answers they're looking for, that would absolutely be a bonus.
So what are some of your solutions you'd like to put forward for actually improving voter turnout?
I think a lot of the problem has to be sheeted back to the local authorities themselves and to the elected representatives and to the candidates. You know, candidates who stand by saying, I'm the anti-politician, or vote for me to keep rates down, and label themselves as independent, aren't really presenting a vision of the future that people can believe in. And I think we need candidates who are upfront about their values and what they're doing there. We need to be more excited by our candidates. I think that would help. I think local authorities need to reconnect with their communities, and not just at election time. Democracy is about the entire 3 years. As we've lost a lot of local media, we have to think of new ways of connecting people to what's actually happening in their councils and ensuring that people can follow what's happening should they wish to. I'd also like to see civics being a requirement in schools, and if we could lower the voting age to the point where most people were still at school when they first became eligible to vote, we could enrol people while they were at school. Students could then be told about how to update their details about why we vote, why it's important to be on the roll and things like that. I think as our turnout is falling, more and more young people are growing up in households where voting in local elections is not the norm. So where do they learn about local government? And where do they get the help to actually do the basic things like get on the roll and figure out what to do if their voting papers don't turn up?
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
That was Jack Marshall talking to Dr. Julian Molyneux of the Policy Observatory on how to improve the problems with local elections. Over to you, Justin.
Thanks very much, Louis and Jack. Ko te waia tēnei maronga BFM. We will be back after a few messages.
Bike Auckland presents Biketober, a month-long community-created bike fest. Warmer days and longer nights make spring the perfect time to jump on your bike. And Biketober brings loads of ways to get amongst it.
Sweet.
With bikes and beers, art adventures, e-bike expeditions, poetry on wheels, and pump track hoons, there's a Biketober event for everyone. Biketober is presented by Bike Auckland, your voice for a better city for people on bikes. Check out the calendar at bikeauckland.org.nz. I love bikes.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
Oktober features Greengrove, Tassiana, Ngātai, BB Girl, and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Welcome back to The Wire. And finally for today, after being away for 2 weeks, we have another catch-up with our Australian correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe Canendes. And this week we talked about Extinction Rebellion protests in Australia and the collapse of White Ribbon Australia, a charity to end male violence against women and girls.
Recently, the White Ribbon Australia has closed its doors. It's gone into voluntary liquidation. I'm not sure if you have White Ribbon in New Zealand or a similar foundation, but it is to stop violence against women. They campaign as an advocate. It's sort of like a charity for men to sort of take a step up. But they've gone into liquidation, as I said. The organisation has said the decision became necessary after they sort of analysed their future and their sustainability. It just wasn't possible. And this has been sort of come with good and bad responses. Well, not good and bad responses, just a mix of responses, rather, I prefer to say. You know, White Ribbon Foundation, when it did exist, did have a lot of sort of backlash for how they went about their campaigning against domestic violence. And it's almost come to some as a good thing that this has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, Australia does have a lot of good other foundations as well,
doing
similar work. So when I say a good thing that's happened, that's because there's other places doing similar things.
Right. But why did White Ribbon Australia go down, though?
Well, last financial year, the charity registered a loss of 800,000. Dollars. And it just seemed that when they were looking into the future of how this charity would continue, they were unable to find any sources of funds.
These funds will have to be private. They have to look it for themselves, don't they?
So a non-profit private organization.
Yep.
So yeah, they were they were collecting funds for themselves. I'm not sure if they were attached to the government or had any funding from the government, but they were finding these sources for themselves. Yeah, so that's why.
Right. And moving on to another topic, Extinction Rebellion, that has been quite a global movement. We have this in Wellington, and I believe they have similar protests in Australia as well.
Yes. So it's all been kind of kicking off a lot lately for Extinction Rebellion. We had massive turnouts all across the country for our global climate strikes a few weeks ago now. Mm-hmm. And not to say that Extinction Rebellion wasn't around before that, but it just feels like lately they've been making a bit more noise, especially since these protests. But they've also been met with some really high criticism. You know, it's some criticism that makes sense and some criticism that doesn't. The criticism that doesn't is these protests are obviously quite peaceful. I think it's everyone knows that Extinction Rebellion are peaceful protesters. They're not really doing anything out of harm's way. They're sort of just making a bit of noise and perhaps getting in the way of people and in the way of traffic, right? But in Sydney, we've seen some really crazy protesters being arrested, and then their bail conditions means that they can't contact anyone. They can't go in 2 kilometres within the CBD, so they can't see their friends. Also in New South Wales, I'm so sorry, but the name evades me, but one of the premiers, they said that these climate change protesters, when they're arrested, they should have their New Start or their welfare payments taken away from them. And it is a sort of something that they're trying to pass. I'm not entirely sure about it, but that's sort of absurd as well. And, you know, general public and a lot of, social commentators in Australia, you know, the hosts of breakfast shows and this, that, the other, are all sort of up in arms about these protesters, don't really like them. On a more serious level, there are criticisms of them not, they seem to be quite white, if that makes sense. They're not putting the voices of Indigenous people at the forefront of climate action, which I think is a very important thing to do. So there is some, you know, criticism towards the group that does make sense as well.
Right. But has the federal government in Canberra responded to all these protests for climate action?
Well, that's another thing. They sort of seem to be making a lot of noise, and they've got, you know, in the headlines for maybe the past 2 weeks straight. But it just doesn't seem like the government is sort of paying too much attention. I know there is a petition circling at the moment that the government, I don't know, if you sign it, enough signatures, the government's going to listen. I don't know how legit that is. But, yeah, you know, I think they're making a lot of noise, and they're, you know, they're smart, they know what they're doing. They're, you know, trying to get in the headlines, trying to get people to think about it. But there hasn't been much response yet from the government. And I say yet, quite hopefully, because I'm really hoping that the government listens.
But what has been Scott Morrison's response? What has been Scott Morrison's view on climate change in general? Now, when he went to New York last at the UN General Assembly and said Australia has done its job.
I mean, I probably shouldn't say these big statements. I'm trying to be unbiased, but he's a climate change denier. It's really awful. He loves coal. He loves destroying the earth. And, yeah, I genuinely think that he thinks that we've done our job and that we're, you know, making steps towards this, that, the other. But, no, he's a climate change denialist.
Thanks very much, Zoe.
Thanks. Thanks, yeah. Justin.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was The Wire.
And that, Ko rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, and that was The Wire for the 10th of October. Thank you all for tuning in. On the show today, we had Finance Minister Grant Robertson, Fonso Martini, Dr. Lara Greaves, Dr. Julianne Molyneux, and our Australian correspondent Zoe Canendez. And last but not least, my producer Louis Laws, who makes sure I didn't get too lonely this week. Also, thanks to Jack Marshall for that excellent piece on online voting. Ka hoki mai mātou a Te Rā Wiki. We will be back next week with Stuart and Mary Margaret as well. Remember, we've got the full show and all our interviews up on our website at 95bfm.com/bcas. And just a final reminder, following this theme of the show, voting for local elections closes at noon this Saturday. It is too late to post your vote now, but you can drop your paper off at your local library, or even you can vote there. Up next, it's the 124 with Sigrid. Enjoy the rest of your week. Mā te wā.
Yeah. That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.